Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at weather. We'll look at some upcoming winter storms, maybe some new research on climate change that's out there. Certainly, we're always happy to answer your questions or take a shot at it when you give us a call. Our weather guy, Steve Ackerman. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. He's also, of course, a professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor and chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, will be joining us in a few minutes. But Steve is with us for now. Certainly, if you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page as well at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And, oh, also, we always get some great weather photos. So if you got a great clouds or other kind of weather photos, I hope you'll pass those along, too, on my Facebook page. Steve, good to see you.
It's good to be here. It's cold February. That's coming to a close.
Oh, well, we've got a new report just came out on climate.
Yeah. Trends. NOAA came out with looking at climate trends for the Midwest specifically. So they look at the publications that are out there and kind of put them all together in a 100-page report, which is required by a congressional act back in the 90s. As we've been expecting, I guess, we're going to see continued trends for the Midwest to be warming up by the year, you know, continuing that trend up to about 2050 is where they went.
Up to 2050?
Yeah, so we're seeing, I think, 5-degree increases in the average temperature in northern Wisconsin and about 10 degrees increase in temperatures for southern Wisconsin by the time frame, 2030 to 2050.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of degrees. Yep. Yeah, we've warmed up, I think, maybe by a half a degree now. So,
yeah, and then here I got something in the mail, a postcard telling me that supposedly there's nothing to this global warming or climate change, at least that it's been caused by humans.
I would not necessarily. I would imagine that that's a political card rather than a scientific card.
Oh, man.
Because the changes that we're seeing are what we would expect by the laws of physics. And our models, even though we have a wide variety of them, they all tend to predict the same thing. There's some variability because the models are a little bit different. But, when you get that it's not happening, then you have to be suspicious of what the ultimate goal is. Because it's not scientific. It's probably political.
Yeah. It said on the card, the notion that humans are causing some kind of man-made disaster because of carbon dioxide emissions. That is a...
Yeah, carbon dioxide, physics, we expect it to change the energy budget of the planet and lead to a warming, and all the trends that we're seeing are doing that. And not just the measurements. We're seeing that in animal life as well.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, and
I wouldn't buy the book.
No.
That's what they're selling.
that's unfortunately, that's what they're selling.
They are, yeah. I wouldn't buy it.
Oh, man.
I'd get the NOAA book because, you know, they don't make political statements. They say, here's what's happening and here's what the projections are. And then we can figure out what to do about it.
There's some interesting findings on the impact of climate change on species, animals.
Yeah, there's been a couple of recent studies. One that came out about 6-7 months ago was on caribou. What they were finding is that the caribou, the breeding season, so when they calf, hasn't changed because that's developed over a millennium of time. But what has changed is the length of frozen and therefore when trees and bushes will bloom out. And that's occurring earlier. And the timing of the calving used to be so that when the blooming is occurring, the calving is happening. So they get a lot of nutrients in the plants. And now they're out of whack. So they're blooming earlier, and when the calving is occurring, it's not they're not getting that healthy vegetation.
So that's a price. I saw one, too. There's... climate change disrupting the migration of monarch butterflies.
Yeah, that one just came out. Really interesting in the sense that When the butterflies migrate south in the fall, they do it primarily keyed on seasons. So they're looking at where the position of the sun is in some way, and they all go to one mountain down in Mexico. For the northward return migration, scientists just recently discovered through a bunch of experiments that what kicks them off is not the position of the sun, which I guess they knew for a while, but is rather the temperature. And so when the temperature gets within a certain range for a certain amount of time, then they begin their migration north again. And they don't understand why that's the case or the real details of the specifics, but they're realizing that temperature is playing a role. And so now the issue is, as that region warms up more, that's going to change when they do their migration patterns. And again, how that is going to be related to food supplies is going to be interesting.
Yeah. Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, one of our weather guys from the UW-Madison, our guest now as we talk climate and weather with him. Questions? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. When Paul Kinzer was on just a few minutes ago, as he was concluding, he mentioned the Yerkes Observatory, and that's sort of related to a caller from Milwaukee. And several people called to say, hey, the Yerkes Observatory, don't forget it's in Williams Bay. So so it's in Williams Bay and Yerkes. It's why don't you put up a link to it? We'll put a link to the Yerkes Observatory on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and otherwise you can probably just Google it and you're going to find it. Hmm. So I wanted to bring that up. We got talking about meteors and the big blow in Russia.
Oh, right, yeah.
Of a couple of weeks ago, that had it come in at a different angle, probably would have wiped that city of a million people, just wiped it out.
Yeah, I think if it would have come in at a different angle, exploded a little lower in the atmosphere, like a mile above, half a mile above, yeah, that would have been a totally different thing. And this is the type of thing where we still think is what caused the demise of the dinosaurs. It's a big meteor.
A
big bang, right, yeah.
Very big
down
bang.
In the, causing the Yucatan Peninsula there to develop.
Oh, man. Well, I tell you, the questions are coming in here, so maybe we should go to the phones. Tim and Eau Claire, let's give you a chance. Hi, Tim. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a few different angles to the same question, I guess. One is poisonous spiders and poisonous snakes. Living in northern Wisconsin, we don't have brown recluse spiders, and we have very, very, very few rattlesnakes. Yep. They seem to like a little bit warmer climate. The other part of that question is, can you see a time when they adjust our seed catalogs again so that we'll be getting those warmer plants? And how long do you think it'll be until we're growing oranges in Wisconsin?
Ooh, good questions. They just redid the plant zones.
Yep.
That was this year.
Yes.
They started to do it, I guess, a couple of years ago and then stopped. When would they do it again? That's a good question. If I had to predict, I'd probably go with, those plant zones are generally based on the minimum temperatures in wintertime, and that's what we're seeing the big change. So maybe another 10 years or so.
Yeah, or even less.
Decade, maybe even less, given how fast things are changing. Rattlesnakes, I grew up in, I didn't grow up. I grew up in New York, but then lived in Colorado for 10, 11 years and saw a lot of rattlesnakes, because they have a lot of them out there in the Great Plains. But it's dry. And so even as we warm up in Wisconsin, also looking at precipitation, increasing a little bit maybe, maybe not changing much in the summertime. And so I don't think we'll see rattlesnakes, move northward. But brown recluse spiders, I'm not sure what kind of moisture conditions they want. And then they're so recluse, right? They just hide.
They're south. I mean, it's humid, hot and humid.
Yeah, hot and humid, I would think, would support
them in
that.
Georgia,
yeah.
For example.
I mean, we see the African bees moving northward a little bit.
I'd much worry more about those than the brown recluse spider. Although, I mean, they turn up here in Wisconsin now, the brown recluse, but they came in on something food or, you know, some food product or something.
Yeah.
So.
So, yeah, we're going to be see changes in the environment over the next 20, 30 years for sure.
Yep. There we go. Thanks, Tim, for calling. Appreciate it. We've got severe weather spotter classes coming up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. April, I guess, is the month of severe weather alert. And so, yeah, March, I would imagine they start coming up and start doing lessons out of the National Weather Service offices in Milwaukee and Green Bay and probably La Crosse.
And we have Steve, one of our listeners, posted a link on Facebook, on our Facebook page, to the several weather spotter classes that are coming up. What are those classes like? Are you familiar with them at all?
I'm familiar with them. I have to confess I've never took them. But I've always, not always, I've looked at the PowerPoints and the material that's distributed. And they're very valuable things to get because they tell you how to identify, for example, a tornado. And that becomes really important for identifying where tornadoes actually occurred. If you're not trained in it, there are features that could appear in clouds that look like tornadoes, but they're really not tornadoes. And so that training is really valuable. That weather co-op that the National Weather Service has developed of people who really like the weather, like observing the weather, and report their weather observations to the National Weather Service is a true value to the country and to forecasting. So it's a good thing to do.
Good thing to do, and typically, I don't even think it. Do they charge a small fee?
I would doubt that they charge anything. I think they do it as a service because it is so valuable to them.
Yeah, I'll have to go on.
They
my
may
own.
Even give free donuts. I don't know.
I'll have to go to my own Facebook page here and look, go online and look and see what the heck. Steve left us there. Our listener who posted a link to the upcoming classes. So. We'll do that. And here's something that just to think about from Nina, who says, wonders how she can explain to her less scientifically inclined friends that climate change is a real thing, that it is happening, and that it is caused by man. It's really frustrating for her, and that's something we'll ponder. And we will discuss that with Steve Ackerman, and John Martin will be joining us as well, after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, there are times when weather can leave you breathless, whether it's a gorgeous double rainbow or maybe it's a devastation caused by a tornado. It really impacts everything you do, from gardening in warmer weather to making sure your home can keep those cold winter temperatures at bay. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Whether it's a storm like Sandy or an intense blizzard that covers our state, good idea to respect the power that weather has. And we're lucky to have our weather guys with us from UW-Madison here until 12:30 to explain it. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, they share what they know about climate and weather, and they're happy to answer your questions when you call. And that number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Don't forget, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Last year, you know, we had an incredibly warm March. Felt more like summer than early spring throughout the state. It's unusual and unexpected weather like that. It keeps us on our toes. To tell you what, we're lucky to have a monthly visit from our UW weather guys to help us understand what we're experiencing and to know what's in store for us. Steve Ackerman with us. He was with us for a few minutes earlier here, 15 minutes or so, joined by John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back.
Thanks. Yeah. Great. You too.
Yeah. Great to have you both here. And sort of as we were ending the first segment before the newscast, we'd gotten a note from Nina who wondered how she can explain to her less scientifically inclined friends that climate change is a real thing, it's happening, and is caused by man. She finds it very frustrating. People say, well, no, that's a bunch of baloney. And
yeah, there's
blow
a lot
it
of,
off like that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of misinformation that gets propagated out there in order to support that misconception that climate change isn't really happening. There's a really good website, and I cannot remember the name of it now.
Yeah, me either.
That, you know, that actually goes through the arguments when an argument comes out that says, well, you know, since 1998, it's been colder. And they show how they come to that statement, which is an inappropriate statistical statement to say. And so they address those things, but I can't remember the name of it. I'll have to try and think of it as we go through it. You know, the other thing is that I think that begins to bring the argument, particularly in a non-scientific one, if you don't want to argue the data, and the data clearly shows it, and the physics clearly shows it, is to now look at, you know, the companies, private industry, armed forces are now planning for climate change. And so, hard to argue if the Navy's thinking, you know, we got to deal with sea level rise and we got to plan for it in our ports. We got to think about what's going to happen when the ice sheets are gone.
Really good point.
They're accepting the science.
Insurance companies were way out ahead of everybody
right.
in this.
Yeah.
And that's where the money is. So, you know, if you follow the bets of the insurance companies. I think that's a safe thing to do almost all the time.
Right. If you don't want to follow the science, follow the money.
Yeah, right.
There you go.
And not the contribution money.
Right. And resist the temptation to substitute assertion for reasoned argument.
Georgia and Wapaka, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I promised my daughter some time ago that the next time these guys were on, I would call and ask, who is it that names storms? And how long have they been putting names on winter storms?
Oh, God, that's a good question. The Weather Channel is a commercial entity. They are completely in control of this storm name, this winter storm naming thing that's gone on this year. Unfortunately, it kind of leads people to believe that the National Weather Service has been doing it, which couldn't be farther from the truth. The Hurricane Center does name storms in agreement with other agencies in the Northern Hemisphere. They name storms well in advance for the tropical storm season, and some of those storms never get to the maturity to earn the name. But this winter storm naming stuff is purely commercial. It's purely commercial, and it's done by the Weather Channel only.
Oh. And do they have rules? Okay, I've been trying to figure out if they
for the summer ones and the Weather Channel. Weather Channel probably has no rules.
The summer one has international agreements. Yeah,
right.
Hall of Fame status. They get retired. But the winter storms, I don't know what the rules are, because winter storms are very different from these. Extratropical storms are different from tropical storms. They can last for several days and affect different regions with vastly different weather. And I don't know why you call it the same thing all the way through. It's just a whole different animal. So it's kind of goofy.
Yeah. And you can tell a lot of the weather geeks aren't really happy about it.
I think you don't need to name the thing to pay attention to it. And if we do need to name it to pay attention to it, I think that's a really sorry statement.
Yeah.
There you go, Georgia.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Listener Rod wonders if there is a viable way, or if anybody's working on a viable way, to harness the power in an electrical storm to actually be able to use the energy. Man, think of the energy in a storm.
Huge amounts of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe Franklin was thinking about it.
Yeah.
You all kind of talk about don't put a key on that.
Yeah, right. I think it's a capacitance problem. Those charges are so huge and they come all at once that I don't think there's a way right now that you can deal with that.
Yeah,
you
just store
it. Yeah, you blow out whatever you're going to try and store it in right away, because these are just such enormous charges.
Yeah.
It would be great if we could do that. There's a lot of incoherent energy in the atmosphere that, you know, we just can't tap. And that's one prime example right there.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
I wish you could. People have thought about it.
Yeah, we're thinking about it, but we don't have any expertise. I don't know what the stumbling blocks are, but I'm pretty sure they're big. But I wonder. No, but in all honesty, maybe some people really are thinking about how could you mitigate against that giant flow at the front end? You know, maybe you could distribute the flow over a network underground or something. If you kind of attract lightning to a particular spot, and you could somehow channel it into storage devices. I don't know. Maybe someone is thinking about it.
And that's always the challenge, is where do you store it? Where do you put it? Because you then have to distribute it.
Yeah, right.
And that's a lot of energy that comes in at once.
Yeah, man.
But I would think you'd be able to, wouldn't you be able to have an area where you could attract you know, if a storm was coming, you could attract lightning to a particular mass of...
I think there's people who... What are those things called? Those melted stone that turns into glass?
Yeah, fugolite.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. There's people who go out to beaches when there's a thunderstorm coming, and they put up these giant metal poles, and then that's how they build these things, and then they sell them as tourist things, and they're really beautiful. So I guess you can attract the lightning.
I mean, we also have things like the Eiffel Tower, which is also pretty good at attracting.
Yeah, which...
They get hit a lot, and the New York Empire State Building also gets hit a lot. But they have rods in there to take the energy out and distribute it down so people don't get hurt.
Yeah. I think the analogy might be trying to leave the old one about trying to drink from a fire hose. You know, when you turn the thing on, there's just so much coming out at once that you don't have really a way to handle that capacity.
I've been up on the Eiffel Tower a couple times, but to be perfectly honest, looked like it was going to be a storm, I would not have been going up
there. I've been up there a couple of times, too, and I only do it on clear days. Not just for the view, but it would make a bad headline.
Yeah, right.
Where the cat killed by lightning strike out of the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, man. Our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, as our weather guys, talking with them about climate and weather. And we'll take some calls now. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. Michael in Washburn, thanks for calling. Hi.
That was quick. Hi. I have two questions, actually, and the main question I'll ask a second. But I happened to think when you were talking about this, you started out the program talking about a card you got about a book, about climate change, and then you just mentioned... I think it was a link, internet link that talked about temperatures getting colder and so on and so forth. I've noticed, and this is sort of a general anecdotal note observation, that a lot of decisions, be they DNR decisions, be they school evolution or science weather, there's this general distrust of science. And you can choose to discuss that or not. My main question is on the National Weather Service page, and I often go to the one on climate that has this sort of flow chart with 48-day forecast and 6-10 and 8-14 and monthly and seasonal, where, and I know the difference between climate forecasting and meteorological forecasting, where do they make the break? In other words, when they use statistical models that are based on historical models, What do they use to forecast on that page, and what do they use? When do they actually use current weather systems? In other words, highs and lows, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, the medium range forecast can go. You can find places where it'll go out to as far as about 15 days, and I'd say at about 10 days or so, you're really crossing a boundary that's probably a substantial one. But all of them, all the way out to 15 days, are initial condition forecast models, and so they really do pay attention to what the conditions are at the beginning of that forecast run. The climate models, or even the monthly forecast, the seasonal forecasts, do not operate in that way. They are much more statistically based right from the get-go, so they don't pay that much attention to the initial observations on December 1st to make a forecast for January through March, for instance.
Okay. So that's 8-14 day forecast would actually be based on something that's currently happening.
That's correct. That's correct.
Beyond that, it's just statistics.
That's correct. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
And you can choose to discuss the other question or not, but it occurred to me as you were discussing as down the road, there's this major distrust of science anymore, so.
Yeah.
And I suppose you run into it there, too. So I'll listen to you off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't know. The last research I saw where they actually, talked to people and surveyed them and asked them about if they trust scientists in particular, that the answer was yeah. So I think that there's still trust in scientists. It's when you get to certain things like evolution or climate change where you have a group that's advocating the opposite of what the science is showing is where I think confusion comes up.
Yeah. It would be interesting if there was a big anti-airplane lobby saying, this plane won't
be able to
think
fly.
About it. It weighs 600,000 tons. It's not going to be able to fly. People take that for granted. That's science. But there's no anti-airplane lobby. If there were, I wonder how many people would be nervous about flying.
Right.
Yeah. Well, good question. I went online. I was trying to find the debunking.
Oh, right.
So why don't you page up that take a look and see if you can find the one. In the meantime, let's go to Claire in Hubertus. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I believe in science 100%. And thank you for all your work. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks.
I have a question that's been bothering me a long time. Wisconsin has a lot of storms that come from the west and head toward the lake. And as soon as it gets to the lake, the scientists talk about the dry air near the lake. How can that be?
You're thinking about summertime storms, I think. Is that right?
Well, even the most recent storm, it kind of dissipated. And because of the dry air.
Yeah, that's not the reason why it dissipated. So your suspicions are aroused and accurate. That's not a good explanation. In the summertime, some of the thunderstorms that seem to weaken as they go closer to the lake, that could be for a number of different reasons. Almost none of them have to do with there being dry air, as you correctly assumed, in the vicinity of the lake. It would be just the opposite. In our most recent snowstorm, we were seeing that thing kind of falling apart as it stumbled towards the Great Lakes from the southwest. And the one that's down over Texas Panhandle today that'll give us a little bit of snow on Wednesday, Tuesday night and Wednesday, is undergoing the same sort of evolution, which is a sort of a stumble-bum evolution. It's falling apart as it moves to the northeast. And it has nothing to do with dry air, and especially nothing to do with dry air near the lakes. That's just not a fair explanation. You are right on.
Thank you very much.
All right.
It relieves my mind.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
At RealClimate.com.
Oh, there you go.
RealClimate.com. And that's for Nina, who wondered, whose less scientifically inclined friends don't believe that there's climate change. This is, and anybody else, if you want to go to a spot that will answer those questions.
Yeah, they did. RealClimate.com. They do a nice job of, explaining things in terms that, you don't have to be a scientist to understand.
I really like them. Mary in Madison, hello to you.
Yes. Hello. I saw a NOVA program. It was 2 hours, and it dealt with everything that you're talking about. And it seems as though... as far as air currents and wind and ocean currents, that excluding the sun, that the Earth rotation was what generated those two. Is there anything else?
It's primarily the two things you touched on. One is the uneven heating of the globe by solar energy. And then the fact that the Earth rotates, and that generates forces that make the ocean currents and the atmospheric currents meander around.
Yeah, and then there's internal dynamics within those currents that are very local, and they get determined by the exact distribution of the wind, the temperature, and various other things that result from the basic ones that Steve just mentioned. So it's really an interesting set of problems. But you're right. That's right. That's really at the foundation.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Don in Warren, Illinois. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I wanted the weather guys to speculate on the fact that we live right on the edge of the last glacier. So we got one side that's maybe green in the summertime, and the other side we got, hundreds of feet or thousands of feet of permanent snow and ice. What would that do to the weather?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah. I've always wondered the same thing. I think it would have huge impact on the weather. It would seem to me the place that's covered by the deep and a tall ice sheet would constantly be colder. You'd have all kinds of local weather effects at the boundary, probably be really windy at the boundary, like it is on the southern tip of Greenland. You'd probably have quite a number of really intense winter storms that would kind of find their way to the edge of that ice boundary. And I don't even know what would happen in the summer. It might be really weird in the summertime, but that would be something else. There's evidence that suggests places in Iowa, places in our own state, were very, very much windier at the surface 10,000 or so years ago, which might be one of the manifestations of this really extreme weather that could have occurred right on the ice edge. So there's a lot of work being done on that, not so much by myself or maybe even people in our own department.
Yeah,
not
maybe
so much,
you're
but
right,
geographers,
yeah.
I think, are doing a lot of that stuff.
There you go.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Don, for calling. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Well, one caller called in and asked for a spring forecast. Have you got one of you?
You know, I just looked at that, and again, as John was pointing out, this is a statistical forecast that looks at, you know, what's been happening and how that affects the future. And they're going for, and by there I mean NOAA, for a warmer than normal spring and a wetter than normal spring, which means that the groundhog would probably be right.
He doesn't do a
precipitation forecast, but
even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while.
Well, listener Ken from Little Chute would like a weather book recommendation for someone with a science background. You know, so somebody with a may have, you know,
an introductory weather book. I would quickly jump to a great introductory textbook that has lots of color photos by fellows named Ackerman and Knox.
Yeah, that's very good. That's very good.
And then, John, if you really want to know about mid-latitude winter storms, John's got a great book out there, too.
No color images in that one, though.
That's why I made the distinction.
Yeah. So, Steve's book is great for exactly that. If you really want to get a nice view of the broad science at an introductory level, but not a non-science introductory level, so you can look at it as a scientist too.
All right. So, and what's the title?
It's called Meteorology: Understanding the Atmosphere.
Very cool. All right.
And any of the editions. I mean, the latest edition gives you more, recent phenomena like Katrina and things like that. That's why we always have to update weather books because something big happens.
So there you have it, and it's available.
It's available, yep. Go on Amazon.com and search around and find a good price that fits you. You can probably find used ones that are relatively too expensive. New ones are probably going to be expensive.
But they're also going to be up to date.
They'll be up to date, right, yeah.
Bill and Merrill, hello.
Hello. Yes, I just had a question about, can the average person take any stock at all in the Old Farmer's Almanac? And how do you view about people planting their gardens by moon phases and so forth? Mm-hmm. I'll take my answer off here.
All right.
I would go by moon phases if you're planting at night. You'd make it a lot easier to see in a full moon than in a
And I might buy moon. Stock in the Farmer's Almanac because it is a successful commercial enterprise, but I certainly wouldn't take any stock in the weather part of it. As I've said several times on the show, to the frustration and sometimes comedy of my colleagues here, there's nothing to the weather forecasts. There's nothing at all to the weather forecasts in the almanac. But it's a great book. I don't disparage the book, but the weather forecasts, like, we should leave that to humans.
The book's fun, though.
It's a great book to read. That's why I say I'd buy stock in it in a second, because it's always going to be popular, and it deserves its popularity, but not for the weather.
Still got that punch hole in the upper left corner.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. You can hang it in your shed.
Yep. Hang it in your shed. Right. Zach in Mequon, hello.
Hey, Larry. How you doing? How's it going, guys?
Good.
It's not so much a question. It's more of a comment, like the choice of words, the verbiage when you were saying that humans cause, you know, by that previous caller, humans cause, you know, global warming. And maybe one of the disconnects we have is starting off on the wrong foot. And it'd be more appropriate to say that humans contribute to global warming. And if we know that we contribute, not necessarily cause volcanoes and other things cause, also, you know, contribute to, but just maybe choosing our words, you know, that way would allow people to be more receptive, to the message. And
That's a good point.
Fair. Otherwise, it can sound like a scold. Yeah, that's fair.
Right, yeah, that's right.
And it's accurate, too.
Yeah.
Yep, wonderful program, you guys. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, well, certainly a volcano is going to have...
I like John's comment, too. It sounds very accusal. Causing this, darn it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Sandy was caused by us. And it's just like, well, no, we contributed, but not not necessarily caused. There are other things that are leading to things.
It's not safe to say, you know, to blame one thing on one other thing in our state of knowledge, but it's pretty certain that we're contributing. And I think that's a good description.
Are we going to wind up, how's the snowfall? It seemed like we've had... At least in southern Wisconsin, there have been lots of little ones, and then we had a couple of big ones. Yeah.
We're at 2 inches now, which is about twice normal, I think.
We're above normal in February, and we're above normal for the year in Madison. I don't know about other parts of the state, but not much above normal. I'll say that. It's been sort of a normal winter, hedged toward a little bit above. Yeah.
And 20 days. If you include traces of precipitation, we've had 20 days out of 20, what is today, 25th of 20?
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, 20 out of 25 days that we've had precipitation of some sort, rain or snow.
It's been a really weird month of February, because it's usually the driest month of the year.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I am sick of doing my driveway.
Yeah, I know. And the ice keeps coming back. It's going to be cold again this week, so there'll be a little melting during the day and freezing at night, characteristic, I guess, of February. So, yeah, ugly. Yeah.
Well, hopefully when we next get together, things are going to be warmer.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. It'll be March.
I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready.
Although if it's not, we could blame it on the groundhog being wrong again.
Yeah, that's right. I'll do that right now.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, they'll be back the last Monday in March. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.